It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we look at the open source seed initiative that kicked off a rally at a rally on the UW-Madison campus yesterday.
And our resident foodie Lori Skelton tells us what to do with that early spring green sorrel that's making its appearance at farmers markets right about now.
But first, a group of scientists, food activists, and students yesterday took a stand against the practice of filing for patents on seeds with the launch of a new open source seed initiative.
This initiative pledges to preserve seed diversity and provide seed that is patent-free to anyone who wants to use it. Irwin Goldman, UW-Madison Professor of Horticulture, is with us to tell us why it works and why it was important. Irwin, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on the show.
So tell us about the Open Source Seed Initiative. Where did this idea come from?
Well, I think plant breeders have been sort of puzzling for the last several decades about what our future will look like if all of our seeds become somehow legally protected through various forms of patents or licenses. And, you know, while that certainly has its place in the seed industry, if everything became tied up, I think it would be very difficult for plant breeders and some farmers to find freedom to operate.
And yesterday was the kickoff day. Why that day?
Well, yesterday was Via Campesina's International Day of Action on Seeds, particularly focused on seed sovereignty. And that's an international peasant organization that cares a lot about the rights of seeds. And I think as seeds around the world become more and more protected, one of the questions that farmers have is, how will we sustain our food system? And so being able to, say, save and replant one's own seeds, which is a practice that farmers have been doing for thousands of years, or breeding the plants that one would like to breed is something that, you know, is increasingly threatened with these forms of legal protection.
Let's dive into that a little bit more. Why is it under threat right now, do you think? What's happened?
Well, I think you know, to breed a new variety, to develop a new cultivar is very expensive, and it requires a lot of capital investment. So it completely makes sense that companies would want to protect those investments through licenses. And to be completely candid, the university where I work also protects the varieties that I develop through licenses and patents. And I think that is a good way to bring revenues back, in my case, to my own breeding program or to the university. But we sought a way to sort of set aside some genetic resources, some sort of a separate channel or a separate pathway so that we could put some genetic resources out in what we call a protected commons that would remain available for anybody who wanted to use them.
What kind of seeds generally get patented versus the kinds of seeds that you're trying to set aside to make for the common use?
Well, that's an excellent question. Actually, you know, in the beginning years, the big crops, corn, soybean, cotton, and that sort of thing were the type that were being patented. But increasingly, even the minor crops. One of the crops I breed is carrot, and in recent years, a number of companies have filed for patents on a number of carrot varieties. So if that sort of trend continues with even some of our more minor crops, I guess the question becomes, what will our future look like in terms of our freedom to use seeds? I think because plant breeding depends so much on seed sharing, it depends so much on exchanging genetic material. We call it germplasm. That exchange, I think, if there's an impediment to that exchange, I think it threatens our whole food system.
Are you actually actively distributing these open source seeds, or are you just encouraging people to get a hold of them and use them?
Oh, yeah. Well, we did distribute a couple hundred packets of those seeds yesterday at this rally we held on campus. And we have two seed companies involved in this initiative, Wild Garden Seeds and High Mowing Seeds. And those two companies actually sell some of the varieties that we made available. And so gardeners and farmers can purchase through those seed companies, just as they would purchase regular seeds, they can purchase open source seeds, with the difference being that once they receive those seed packets in the mail, they could then save the seeds, share them with their neighbors, breed with them, do whatever they want, as long as they too pledge to not restrict them in any way.
Can you tell us about some of the seeds that you passed out? They have fascinating names. They're kind of fun.
Yes, they do. Well, we have probably the best one is a cress variety called Wrinkled, Crinkled, Crumpled, which I think is pretty well describes that variety. But I released two carrots. One of those carrot varieties is called Sovereign. Of course, this is meant to represent things like seed sovereignty. So the plant breeders, I think, and the farmers who participated in this initiative look to sort of name their varieties after some of the things that they're working on.
Are these heirloom varieties or just special ones that you're putting aside for this project?
Well, I wouldn't call them necessarily heirloom. The breeding that I did happened to come from two open-pollinated populations or two open-pollinated cultivars of carrots. I suppose one could call those heirlooms, and I think some of the other breeders, we did end up releasing 36 varieties of 14 different crops, and so I think some of those 36 varieties do come from heirlooms that have been reselected and rebred by breeders. But some of them represent other genetic materials that would be available from other public gene banks, and they're then bred into a particular type and particular cultivar that's then named and released.
The Open Source Seed Initiative makes a point of crediting the breeders and that, and also part of the pledge to make sure that these seeds are freely available to anyone who wants to use them. As far as that latter goes, how can you make sure that happens? Once these seeds sort of go out into the world, how can you make sure that they keep being available free?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, we're asking people to take the open source pledge. And in fact, we took that all as a group yesterday as part of this this release rally. We recognize that our pledge is likely not legally enforceable, but we're appealing to sort of the moral economy here by asking people to share these seeds in the spirit in which they were given these seeds. And so we hope that that gesture will generate some goodwill among seed sharers and farmers and gardeners, and we hope that they will be able to pass the seeds on in that way.
In terms of sort of the large agribusinesses like Monsanto that say genetically modified seeds and crops are the one way to feed the world, how do you see the Open Source Seed Initiative functioning within in that framework? Do you agree with that?
Well, I do. You know, there's absolutely a place for the kind of high-tech varieties that are being developed by our large agricultural companies. And I would say, from my point of view, the Open Source Seed Initiative is not against that. Rather, it's for something. And what it's for, I think, is, you know, I sort of liken this to a national park. We're taking seeds, we're setting them aside. We all agree as a society that there's value in setting aside these genetic resources so that everybody can use them and so that they cannot get developed or, in this case, tied up. So I guess what we hope for the Open Source Seed Initiative is that it provides a reservoir of these genetic resources in perpetuity for people who would then use them to breed or use them to farm, and in a sense diversifies the seed system.
And in our last 30 seconds here, do you see this sort of these seeds leaving your hands and going forth and, I guess, being fruitful all over the world?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the dream for me, would be that people all over the world take these and develop whatever is adapted to their particular environment, their soil, their climate. And that would make me feel as though the Open Source Seed Initiative had achieved a really important goal, which is that those genetic resources have made their way out into the world and fed people.
Erwin, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on the show.
That was Erwin Goldman, professor of horticulture at the UW-Madison and a member of the Open Source Seed Initiative.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll learn how to take small talk to the next level as a couple of guests help us find things to talk about in any situation.
Right now, it's Food Friday, and we caught up with one of WPR's in-house foodies, Lori Skelton, to check in on what's getting her excited about spring, the leafy green known as sorrel. Lori, welcome to Central Time.
It is a pleasure to be back, sort of.
Yeah?
Because this is the first Food Friday where I haven't brought anything in. I'm feeling a little guilty, but it's not my fault.
I can't wait to hear the story here.
Well, what I wanted to talk about today is my absolute favorite thing in spring. It's the first thing up in my garden every year. It's incredibly easy to grow. It's called sorrel. And some people call it a vegetable. Some people call it an herb. It's a leafy green thing that just springs up the instant the snow is gone from the ground. It has this bright, kind of tart flavor. Some people think it's like lemon. Some people say it's got a kind of a sour note that can really add a zing to a lot of different dishes. Now, I got through this winter when the temperature got down to 40 below, I put on my extra layers and I put up with it. I love winter in Wisconsin. I really wasn't that upset. And then when the months went on and we started to have a little bit longer winter, it's like, okay, I can handle this because I know I've got sorrel coming up in the garden.
Oh, it's the thing that you were really looking forward to.
I was waiting for. And then 2 weeks ago, after I knew the sorrel was starting, I went out to pick my first batch. Now, this is how I knew we had a bad winter. Normally, sorrel is something that rabbits don't bother, at least in my garden, probably because it is so tart. This year, the rabbits ate the sorrel. So this is how I knew Wisconsin had a really bad winter, and I was fine with it until the rabbits ate my sorrel.
I hate rabbits.
Yeah.
Oh, Larry, I'm so sorry.
Well, but the lovely thing is, it is late in April. The farmer's market is starting up this weekend. I'm assuming that even though, yet again this morning, I had sorrel yesterday that was an inch and a half high, and even though this morning the rabbits ate my sorrel.
You moth-eaten rabbit, I'll slice you to ribbons.
I know that there is sorrel out there, and I will put in a plug for next year. If you don't have sorrel in your garden, go to the farmer's market this weekend, find a vendor who has the plants, and put some in, because this is one of the great rewards of having a garden in Wisconsin, is that under most circumstances, you will have something green and bright in your pot or in your soup or in your salad by April. This is a real delight to work with.
Does it grow quickly? Are you hopeful that if you can contain the rabbits,
it does
you
grow,
can get some sorrel
it
still?
It does grow quickly. Okay. And the one thing you do have to remember with sorrel, this is a plant that likes cooler weather. If we have a really hot summer, this bolts very, very quickly, and the leaves go from fun and sour and tangy to bitter tasting. So this is a plant that does require mostly full sun, although a little shade might keep it going a little bit longer into your growing season. But if we've got a really beastly hot June, forget it. You're not going to see anything decent in your garden until probably September again.
And this is the time of year, too, when we can look forward to things like arugula, watercress. How would you compare that with sorrel? Would you put the three together in salad? Or
some people do that. When you're cooking with sorrel, one of its drawbacks is it's very, very similar to spinach in how it acts. It wilts very quickly, and so you can cook it in just a little bit of water and then puree it with lots of wonderful things like potato soup or leek soup or throw it in a stir fry. The problem with it is that it cooks down into this very unappealing camo green color. And so I know a lot of people will cook with sorrel and spinach together. Not so much that they dislike the taste, but the spinach will give it that brighter green color. If you can get around the unappetizing color of it, cooked sorrel is such a delight to mix into, as I say, soups. If you are to just start with a little bit of sorrel in with a stir fry, it adds a great extra bite to fresh greens in a sandwich. It's basic. Think about it the way you would arugula or spinach, and mix it up. Find out what it plays with if you're playing with other greens.
Yeah. Oh, is it easy to come by? Where can I find it if I don't already have it?
If you don't have it, check your farmers markets. Check your friends who forage. There is a version called sheep sorrel that grows wild, and anyone who happens to recognize it probably knows how to use it. So if you don't already have it in your garden, check with friends, and it may be pretty easy to come across it.
I was wondering about that, if it's something that you can just sort of discover. We might have it in our backyard and not even know it.
Sheep sorrel
leaves, if the rabbits don't get to it.
Right. And this year, heaven only knows, sheep sorrel leaves are going to be smaller than cultivated garden sorrel. And it's got just as bright a lemony a flavor, though. And so if you know where it is, it's definitely worth seeking out. If you don't know where it is, find someone who does.
Mm-hmm. This is a strange question I'm going to toss at you, but I know you'll be able to handle that. I know some people use dandelion leaves, too.
Yes.
Would that, and how does that enter the mix?
Well, dandelions are wonderful. As a matter of fact, I made a breakfast the other morning where I sauteed some dandelion greens.
And threw in some
chopped, boiled, leftover potatoes.
I knew I could toss this question to you.
And, just let it talk to itself in the pan for about 5 minutes. Cracked a couple of eggs on top. It was amazing.
Wow.
A little sriracha on top as well. Definitely a great way to wake up. Dandelion greens don't have the tart, the lemony flavor that sorrel does. But if you have a yard that doesn't have pesticides on it, yes, go out and dig up those dandelion greens right now. One, you're getting rid of some weeds if you don't want them on your grass. But again, you can turn around and use those in a very similar way where you might use spinach. I love sauteing dandelion greens. They're great tossed with pasta.
Huh.
And yes, great with eggs. And again, it's a lovely thing to throw in a salad. And of course, the lovely thing to cheat with, wilt it down with a little bit of water or vegetable or chicken stock, throw it in the blender, maybe add a little cream or yogurt. You got a lovely little creamy soup.
Really?
Yes.
I wouldn't have thought of that. And it's, correct me if I'm mistaken, but as the season goes on and dandelion starts to, wither away for the summer, that gets harder to eat, right?
Again, when your leaves are bigger, mm-hmm. have been out for a while, and yes, under Wisconsin summer sun, those leaves can get bitter. It's not going to have quite the same flavor change that sorrel has going from lemony tart to bitter. But I really don't enjoy dandelions much past June. Dandelions, sorrel, all of these greens that say spring to me, I do like them in spring dishes. Besides, by the time we get to June, we've got other things to play with.
That's true. That's true. And it's always something to look forward to. Well, you have a recipe for us to try. What is it this time?
The simplest thing you can do with sorrel is make a puree or a sauce. Take a couple cups of sorrel. Throw it in a pan, again, with just a little bit of water. Wilt it down quickly, and then throw in a couple of tablespoons of butter and wilt it down, let it talk to itself. You can puree it and serve it that way, right on top of other vegetables. It's a great way to wake up the last of your root vegetables, huh. if you wanted something green on top mm-hmm. of your rutabagas or potatoes. If you want to add a little cream to that sorrel puree, it's marvelous on fish, especially fattier cuts of fish. It's amazing on salmon, on mackerel. I'm told that a lot of people like it with lamb. Again, the way you might do creamed spinach alongside of a lamb. It's not one of my favorites. I really like sorrel best when it's with lighter meats. Fish, definitely with chicken. I probably wouldn't do it with duck, but if anybody has a way to get your fatty duck playing well with the sorrel, I know that sorrel plays really, really well with certain fruits like peaches and strawberries. So if you've got a good duck recipe that incorporates peaches, I could see where sorrel might work.
Interesting. Well, this is all very exciting. And now I'll be on the lookout for sorrel. I hadn't really thought about it much until now.
Again, if you don't have it in your garden, I have to put a plug in for get the plants. It's so easy to grow, and it's so rewarding when it is waiting for you next year.
Well, Lori, thank you so much for shedding light on this interesting ingredient.
My pleasure.
It's always fun.
Oh, I hate rabbits.
That was Lori Skelton, our in-house foodie and a woman of many talents, including being a host at Wisconsin Public Radio.
So Lori seems
She's bothered those rabbits.
Those rabbits. I'm a little worried for the rabbits, frankly.
I don't have a yard, so I don't have to worry about this, but I do have a community garden plot. And I think that the reason I haven't had such trouble is because all my neighbors are worried about the rabbits and taking care of it for me. So
taking care of in quotes, whatever
well,
that means.
Whatever's working. I turn a blind eye.
Well, coming up Monday on Central Time, April is Volunteer Month, so we'll talk about why volunteering matters today and how to find opportunities to give back.
And our guest tells us how to protect ourselves online and safely navigate the world of information, online dating, social media, and more.
That's all coming up this Monday on Central Time right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Do you dread heading into a dinner party where you barely know any of the other guests, or toil over what, if anything, to say to the person who's crammed into the seat next to you on an airplane? Well, our guests today say there's a way to make small talk a big deal, and they share their tips for taking everyday conversation to the next level.
Chris Collin is a journalist whose work has appeared in the New York Times and McSweeney's Quarterly, and Rob Bedecker is a writer, performer, and co-founder of the Casper Hauser Comedy Group. Together, they're co-authors of What to Talk About on a Plane, at a Cocktail Party, in a Tiny Elevator with Your Boss's Boss. Collin, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Sure, and Rob, thanks for being here as well.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So why did you set out to write this book? I guess, Collin, I'll start with you.
Yeah. You know, Rob and I both realized that about 11.5% of the time, we just felt this sort of panic come in when we were getting into conversations, either glancing conversations in an elevator or maybe at a dinner party with people we know, but we just sort of wanted the conversation to be going better than it was.
And Chris came to me and he was in tears, literally. He said, we got to do something about this.
Yeah, I'm in tears right now, actually.
And so we wrote a book.
Well, when you did so, did you have a certain type of personality in mind, or is this something for everybody to learn from?
We feel like everybody can learn from it, even if you're doing well. And most of us are doing pretty well. But there are those moments, whether it's in literally in the elevator where we might brighten someone's day, or in the big picture where we want to push a conversation further and go deeper with people we know pretty well. And there are those moments where we can make it more interesting, get out of the rut.
Mm-hmm. It's sort of like having a song in your head for too long. Sometimes we get the same conversation patterns in our relationships. And you think to yourself, God, you know, I had that really awesome conversation at that party or on that date or in that road trip 3 years ago. Why can't they all be like that?
And why can't they be? It seems like there might be something that's holding us back from actually making meaningful conversation with people.
Yeah, well, they haven't read the book yet. That's the problem.
That's the key.
No. I think the real thing is that, well, first of all, we forget the basics, which is be curious. It's so obvious. It's not rocket science, but we sort of get nervous before a party, for example, and we tend to prattle on, and we just forget that listening really is the foundation of a good conversation.
And I imagine a lot of people hold back out of a fear of awkwardness, and maybe that fear of awkwardness makes them more awkward. How do you break that feedback loop of awkwardness?
Yeah, it's the awkwardness death spiral, and we've all been there, where it just feeds on itself, and pretty soon you can't remember what day it is, and your tongue doesn't work. But we advise getting over yourself, in short. Too often we're so worried about looking good or saying something smart. And when you let that go and think about a conversation as a way to enliven a moment or give someone a new thought, then it takes the pressure off you.
So you know, embrace the awkwardness might be one solution. Get around the awkwardness by exposing your ignorance. That's something that we recommend. Instead of trying to be clever, which can cause awkwardness, reveal to whoever you're talking with, you know, I don't think I actually know what thunder is if I were pressed to explain it.
Chris and I came up with this huge list of stuff that we think we should know, but we have no idea. Thunder or diesel, or what's a macchiato, or, you know, how does a microwave work? What's GDP versus GNP? And we're sort of embarrassed that we don't know it. But once we admitted that, we could put our heads together and actually have a really interesting conversation about our own ignorance.
And there's some relief that comes out, too, when you're talking with someone and you both realize you're both idiots. And it's sort of a sweet, poignant moment.
Are you saying that these are things we bring up out of the blue, like, geez, I don't know what thunder is? Or is it something that if thunder happens to come up in a conversation, you admit you don't know what it is?
Well, that's where it sort of hinges on your personality type. If you have it in you to bring up something out of the blue, go for it. It's totally fine to be a little random in a conversation. You know, even if you get a weird look at first, in our experience, people are just grateful that you went out on a limb and are relieved to have met someone who's sort of interesting.
And we like disruption, too. You know, it's okay to throw people off a little bit. Again, you got to read the situation, but it can be refreshing.
Well, the reason I asked that question is because I did read the section of your book called Cold Openings, which seems like some random icebreakers that we can toss into a conversation with someone. Can you give us some examples?
Yeah, sure. You know, a cold opening is something that you would say, Rob's got some right now, that you would say to someone who you really need something just to start the very beginning of a conversation.
And these are kind of disruptive. They're not what people are expecting. But, for example, do you think train conductors get burned out on waving to people? Something we've all, when you think about it, you probably wonder. Or, you know, it's weird how you never hear about ghosts appearing at the gym, right? I mean, they always appear in creepy old houses, but never on the Nautilus machine.
So these are, obviously, these are silly and, you know, it's okay to be silly. But the point is to sort of burn some new neural pathways, get out of the familiar conversations. You know, how many times are we asked, how are you doing? Or what do you do at a party? And we have some alternatives. First of all, if someone says, how are you? Just ignore it. Don't even answer it. Answer the question that you wish they had asked or ask something on your own. Instead of how are you, say, what did you do this morning? Or instead of saying, what line of work are you in? You can ask someone, how did you end up in your line of work? And the reason we advise questions like these is that they ask for a story rather than answers. And when people start telling stories, that's when you can sort of get on a roll.
Hmm. Well, let's say I walk up to you at a party and I say, how are you? How would you not answer that question and answer the question that you wish you had been asked?
Ideally, I would have come to that party 4 minutes early and I would have sort of put my phone in my pocket, checked in with myself, gotten a little in touch with who I actually am. I think we tend to forget that in these busy times. Thought about what I'm curious about. So you say, how are you? And I'm in touch at that point with my curiosity about the Chuckwalla lizard. And I say, I'm fine. Did you know that there's a lizard out there that can live without drinking water? And pretty soon, yes, it's a random thing to say, but pretty soon we're talking about, you know, lizards, or we're talking about the scientists who discovered this. How did they find that out? Again, that's a sort of a jokey thing you can say, but it gets you over the little speed bump of banalities.
Or offer something specific about your own life. So, how are you? I made this breakfast burrito this morning with kale and sorrel, and it was awesome. Then we've got something to push off against and something particular.
We also have one question that you can always have in your back pocket, or if you don't have a back pocket, you can put it in a front pocket. It always works. What kind of car did your dad drive when you were a kid? Now, it sort of sounds like a random question, but I guarantee if you try it, what you'll find is that instantly get someone thinking about their childhood. And that's a source of all sorts of interesting feelings and memories. But it's a specific question, so you don't have to cast about for abstract emotions.
Can we ask you that, Michelle?
This is Cynthia.
Can you ask Michelle that?
Oh, Michelle.
Sorry, Cynthia.
That's okay. Michelle's thinking about it. Well, for me, let's see. My dad drove a number of cars. I remember there was a Bronco in there at some point.
A Bronco.
Okay. A Bronco.
And
yeah.
What's your memory? I mean, can you remember the smell of it or any, you know, like what it was like to be in the car?
I really don't, honestly. I do remember lots of trips to Pulaski, if you can even, you're not even from Wisconsin, but Pulaski is a small city up in northeast Wisconsin, so.
Okay.
Yeah.
So now we have two things to talk with Cynthia about. We can talk to her about Pulaski. We can talk to her about why she's got this failing memory and can't remember the Bronco.
Yeah.
And the town of Pulaski.
Exactly. And then what is Pulaski? And then you have to go on and
what
talk about
Pulaski?
Polka days and all those things. Yes.
See?
Right.
So, here we go.
But there, it seems like there's an inherent danger in going off the beaten path of conversation. If you're walking up to a perfect stranger at a party and you say mm-hmm. something about this lizard that you love so much, mm-hmm. don't they slowly back away from you like, that guy's weird?
Yeah, that's a helpful sieve. Now you know you don't need to waste your time talking to that person.
Okay.
We also recommend failure. I mean, you've got to try something new, and it's not going to work 100% of the time. But if you're not failing sometimes, then you're staying in your rut.
And also, you know, I think in all seriousness, people can tell, they can sort of smell if you're being genuine or not, and if you're coming at things from sort of a playful place. And playful is just a great way to approach conversation. You know, even if you say something weird, if it has the whiff of sincerity and curiosity and absurdity, you know, that's a great starting place. And I think they might back away at first, and then they'll realize that everyone else in the party is actually less interesting, and then they'll come back to you.
Hmm. We're talking with Chris Collin and Rob Bedeker, co-authors of What to Talk About on a Plane, at a Cocktail Party, in a Tiny Elevator with Your Boss's Boss. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're getting advice on how to strike up interesting and memorable conversations, whether on an airplane, at a cocktail party, or in an elevator with your boss's boss.
And we'd love to hear from you on this. What's the most memorable icebreaker you've ever heard or said to someone else? Are you looking for tips on how to carry yourself at your next business meeting or dinner party? You can get in touch with us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking with Chris Collin and Rob Bedeker, and we have Steve and Wanakee on the phone line ready to talk to us. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I just had a thought, wanted to share one of my favorite conversation starters. When you're in an environment where you're maybe even standing in line, waiting around with people for a while, and you know, so, and especially like if you're waiting in a meal line, I'll often just ask people what they'd like to have for dinner, and they'll say, oh, do we get a choice here? And I'll say, no, but if you had a choice, what would you like to have? And then we'll just start getting talking about what their favorite things are, or favorite taste, or favorite flavor. It's just a good random conversation, getter upper and going.
Yeah. Colin,
Steve,
and
I love that. It's funny, and it gets people speaking about specifics. Rob and I are big fans of asking for specifics. I think we all know the feeling of being asked too big and broad a question. You know, what's your favorite thing to do in life? Asking someone what they want to have for dinner is great, and it gets them talking.
And Rob, anything to add?
Yeah, what I like about that is that everybody's got an opinion about something, and steering clear of the delicate subjects of politics and religion, this question Steve brought up allows people to share their opinion. People tend to love to do that.
And a topic that often comes up is, I don't know if it's just a Midwestern thing or what, but the weather. Everybody talks about the weather here in Wisconsin. We've had quite a rough winter, and so that's probably why. But what other areas do you think we should explore besides those predictable things like the weather or, I don't know, the standard small talk that we make with our neighbors and acquaintances?
Yeah. Well, Rob and I actually, we are forgiving of weather talk. First of all, it's when you guys have a huge winter like you did, it's only natural to talk about it. And second, you know, I think as human beings, we sometimes need just the sort of gentle on-ramp into conversation. So you need like a minute or two just to establish who you are and just sort of get comfy. But what we recommend doing is in that minute or two where you're talking about the weather, what you're doing is you're looking for that hidden door in the floor that leads to something a little more personal, a little more interesting, intellectually stimulating, so that you can push on to the next level.
Kids is another topic like that, yeah. Mm-hmm. Or kids or pets. If you don't have kids, everybody's got a story about what their leopard gecko is up to these days, or their 4-year-old. Lets people talk about themselves a little bit. And as Chris said, you're waiting to pivot into something new and unexpected.
Hmm. Let's talk to Max next in Madison. Hi, Max.
Hey, guys. Love the show. I just had a question about college kids. I'm a student at UW-Madison, and coming from a place where I know a lot of my friends, especially girls, it's easy to talk to them. I talk to them just like they're a regular friend. And I was just kind of wondering, like, if you guys had any tips on how to distinguish between whether or not a girl is looking for a serious relationship, or how to start that conversation instead of just more of a one-night opportunity.
Hey, Max. Boy, that's a tough one. let's see. I think probably you just want to get to know each other first. As with any conversation, what do we care about? We care about the big answers. We care about feelings. We care about each other's deepest, darkest secrets. In this case, we care about whether this person wants to be in a relationship with us. But you can't start at a gallop. You do need to sort of warm up first and get to know each other on a sort of more basic level. I don't know. I mean, if you're feeling bold and it seems like the other person is into boldness, you can just ask, I suppose. But I don't know. I think my personal advice might be to start slow and just have fun first, and then sort of you'll know when it's time to ask the bigger questions.
Nobody likes to be painted into a corner.
And go on.
I was going to ask, the women probably have a better perspective on that than we do.
Well, if any women want to offer their perspective, they can do so at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234.
Well, I want to say one more thing to the Maxes of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say you say the wrong thing, either in a romantic situation or just at a party, or let's say you're on a radio show, you call someone by the wrong name. You know, I think we live in panic.
Can't imagine that happening, but go ahead.
We live in panic that we're going to put our foot in our mouth. But guess what? We all do it all the time. It's totally fine. And if you can sort of turn into the skid and embrace the fact that we make mistakes, we're human, I think that actually can be a nice moment. You can fess up that you said the wrong thing, you screwed things up. And pretty soon, it's sort of like we were saying before, you know, admitting to your ignorance. I think you're connecting over your common humanity and your fallibility.
I like that about Max's question. I mean, he was sort of admitting he didn't know the answer and opened up a pretty big topic. Not an easy one with an easy answer, but that's what conversation's about.
And you had said earlier in the segment that we can use conversation to dig deeper into those relationships with people that we already know. This isn't about mastering the art of small talk, but actually connecting on a deeper level. What recommendations do you have for that?
Yeah, I think that's something that we hear from a lot of people, that, you know, they want to have more interesting conversations with their partner or with their good friend, who maybe they used to have really great conversations, but it's been a while and now they sort of just scratch the surface. One thing that we recommend is something we call emotional fracking, is where you're trying to excavate something a little surprising, maybe even a little disruptive in your conversations, to get down to a level that you've neglected for a while. So the book has a bunch of prompts that can help sort of pry something interesting loose. You know, maybe you're on a road trip with your significant other or with a good friend. What if you ask, how would various family members describe you? Describe yourself in 10 words. Would you say you're improving with age or worsening? Describe yourself in one word. You know, those are just sort of, they're a little bit gimmicky, but that's okay because they get conversation going in a new direction.
We also like this idea of hypothetical worlds. So if you had taken a different turn at a key moment in your life, where would that parallel universe you be right now? If you had decided not to go to college or to go to college instead of whatever you did, what would have happened in this hypothetical universe?
Mm-hmm. So these are conversation prompts, but there's other things that we recommend that aren't just sort of things to say. You know, when you're going out with your partner, for example, on a date, do something different. Instead of going to that Italian restaurant, go to McDonald's. Instead of just sitting there and having a beer with your friend, what if you invite that person over at the end of the bar to come talk with you for 4 minutes? Just sort of push yourself out of your comfort zone and see what happens. And will it be hard and will you fail? Maybe, but that's okay.
Let's talk to Brian in Watertown next. Brian, what's your comment or question?
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. It's a great show. Well, I just have kind of a funny icebreaker. I bought a truck in Texas, and I flew one of my friends, and he's an employee, his first time ever flying down to Texas to drive it back. And he happened to sit to a younger girl that was just her first time on an airplane, too, and was flying to Texas to go to college. And he they were just, he could tell that she was uncomfortable and nervous about flying, and he was a little bit too. He didn't know what to expect, and he was looking through the pocket in the back seat, and he happened to pull out the bag in case you get sick. And he said he just looked at her with the straightest face, and he said, if I fill mine up, would you hand me yours? And he said, and they just both bust out laughing, and he said they had a great time and just, you know, talked about everything under the sun the rest of the flight and really had a good time. But it really broke the ice, and I think of that every time I fly, or sometimes just that pops in my head and random, and I laugh.
Mm-hmm.
Could imagine.
Thanks for that story, Brian.
I like that because he took a risk, and it could have gone the other way. And like we say, you'll fail sometimes, but he went big and it paid off and led to an interesting conversation.
And there's a larger lesson there, which is if you always have a vomit bag with you, you know, you don't have to wait till you're on a plane to do that. You can do that anywhere.
Yeah. Chris buys them in bulk at the Costco.
It also reveals, though, that you have a sense of humor. And I think a lot of people connect on that level and know that they've found someone that they can share a laugh with. That's important, too.
Yeah, I agree. Well, we think, I mean, part of the reason the book is half absurd is that we think conversation is sort of a funny, almost absurd little ritual that our species has. And if you can sort of see the humor in it and shine a light on it, then I think, you're in a better place.
So if we find ourselves out and about tonight, we're heading into a weekend here. Give us one thing that we could ask people that might spark some interesting conversation and maybe create a lasting friendship.
We like these dilemmas that, again, everybody has an opinion about. But you can be a little provocative by saying, you know, I can't imagine how someone would prefer cake to pie. And this will often provoke an opinion. They either agree with you or they vehemently disagree with you. But you're off and running because you have a topic of debate that's not personal. It's not too threatening. But, you know, do you like Snickers or Payday better? Would you rather be immortal or have a guaranteed death at age 92 or whatever it is? That one's a little riskier, but it offers some fodder for talk.
And you know, some of our prompts are funny and extreme, but, you know, there's one that you can always do, which is just, what are your plans tonight? I'm not asking you on a date. I just want to know if you're the kind of person who has plans or do you sort of wing it? And you know, it's a small enough topic that they don't have to cast about for big ideas. They can answer that. And pretty soon you're talking about what kind of person you are.
Mm. Well, Rob and Chris, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Cynthia.
You're welcome.
And Veronica. And Michelle.
Chris Collin and Rob Bedecker are co-authors of What to Talk About on a Plane, at a Cocktail Party, in a Tiny Elevator with Your Boss's Boss.
Well, they made up for it with everybody's names. I like those guys.